From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've always been excited about the future of technology, where we imagine something like the Jetsons cartoon with flying cars and robots. But the part of that fantasy that gets left out is what happens to work in the scenario, to the humans replaced by the robots. We're not there yet, of course, but we're getting there. What with self-driving cars and drones, even as I speak, machines are being designed for operating rooms and fast food joints. Today in the program, we're asking, what happens if or when work goes away? The journalist Eric Thompson will join us. He's been looking into that question. This isn't just about the economic effects of a world without work. Thompson also wants to know the effect on human culture. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a special kind of disdain we reserve for the Luddites among us, those who think technology is draining the life out of our culture or taking our jobs. But what if they were right, these naysayers? What if they just got the timing wrong in their predictions of doom? In his new article for The Atlantic magazine, the journalist Derek Thompson says, some of the most sober economists in the world are beginning to worry that those Luddites may have gotten it right. Thompson explores what the world would be like without work, or that is to say, without human workers. With the exponential progress of technology, this is a very real question. And Thompson explores the economic impacts of self-driving cars and drones and factory robots, and not just on the economy, but on the culture. If some of the indicators are on target, Thompson says saving work is more important than saving any particular job. We invite you to join the conversation today. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Derek Thompson is joining us to talk about his article, A World Without Work, the cover story in The Atlantic's July edition. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, where he writes about economics, about labor markets and entertainment, as well as business. And he's joining us from the offices there in New York City. And Derek Thompson, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
I wanted to – so you begin the article by kind of putting our circumstance in today's workforce in the context of another time. This was in 1977. It was one particular day in September when a steel mill in Johnstown, Ohio, shut down. Start with that, if you would, because that's sort of where you begin to give us the picture.
I went to Youngstown, Ohio, not because it is so obviously a city that represents our automated, sleek, tech-driven future, but rather because the city, which used to be one of the cities with the highest median incomes in the U.S. in the middle of the 20th century, perhaps the city with the highest rate of home ownership in the middle of the 20th century, now has become, I think, a national metaphor for the decline of labor. The steel mill shut down. It's on September 19th, 1977. And within 5 years, the city had lost 50,000 jobs, $1.3 billion in manufacturing wages. It was a depression living in a city. And I went there to see, all right, it's been four decades. What is life like there? How has the demise of this pillar of work, this tentpole of an industry, how has its demise affected the way that people see their lives, that people place work at the center of their lives? What are they doing now that this pillar has gone away? And so that became a question that I ask at the beginning and come back to throughout the piece.
It's interesting that, as I mentioned in the introduction, there's always a natural skepticism to this idea that the Luddites are panicking, that we always freak out. As you write about this in the piece, that this is not new, this fear. We always worry about it, but that we always manage to kind of work it out. Things tend to kind of work themselves out. But you say there are distinctive factors about what's going on now that make it quite different.
That's right. My favorite, I think, example, there's a bit of the piece that looks at sort of the history of these predictions that machines are going to take our jobs, which to this point, I think, quite clearly have not been correct. Yeah. My favorite of these incorrect predictions so far is in the 1930s, President Herbert Hoover received a letter warning that mechanical technology was a Frankenstein monster that was going to devour our civilization. And this scaremongering letter came from the mayor of Palo Alto, of all places, which is, just rings with so much beautiful irony. But in looking at the numbers today, why should we think that this time is any different? Let me just run through three main reasons. The first reason is that there are signs in the economy right now that technology is beginning to erode the value of human work. There is a measure of the economy called the labor capital divide, the labor capital ratio, that looks at, all right, how much of economic output is being paid out in salaries and wages. That figure now stands at the lowest level since the government started keeping track in the 20th century. And although there are many theories to explain this phenomenon, one of the more popular ones says that because technology is so cheap and business capital is so cheap, businesses are replacing workers with computers and software. The second really big
there's a statistic that you cite that I think is kind of stunning. You say that in 1964, AT&T had nearly 760,000 workers, and in today's dollars, it was worth $267 billion. Right. Today, AT&T is worth $100 billion more dollars than that. Something like $370 billion. And compared to 760,000 workers in 1964, it has 55,000 workers.
That's right. That's Google, right. Google, today's AT&T, right.
Right, sorry.
Today's AT&T, it's our today's telecommunications giant Google, right, is worth $100 billion more with less than a tenth the size of AT&T's 1964 workforce. And so the point that this makes is that it is so much easier to create tremendous value with fewer employees. And when you sort of run that out a bit, it suggests that a lot of the most successful startups that really scale up are going to be much more labor efficient than the giants of the mid-20th century. So that's sort of the first bucket that I look at for why should we take this argument seriously now. The second bucket is the spread, the mysterious growth of non-working men.
Yeah.
The share of prime age men, that's men between 25 and 54, who are neither working nor looking for work, entirely out of the economy, it's doubled since the 1970s. It's increased as much since the Great Recession has ended than it did throughout the Great Recession itself. And only some of this has been made up by the growth in the female workforce, which itself peaked about 15 years ago. So it does seem that even though we could go through lots of numbers suggesting that, you know, the labor economy is much healthier than this future that I'm predicting, that there are some murky messages behind these sort of statistics behind the main statistics that suggest that not all is well with today's economy. And then the third bucket, so we have the decline of labor relative to capital, we have the growth of non-working men. Finally, you just have to look at the shrewdness of software, the incredible dexterity of this technology that we're facing. My favorite example to sort of make people understand how difficult it is to predict what today's technology is going to look like in 10 years is this. In 2004, there was a study, a paper that some economists wrote. These economists were very bullish about the future of robots, but they said there are some things we know that robots cannot do, like, for example, drive cars. They said there's no way. It's way too complicated. Making a left-hand turn, the visual intelligence, the spatial intelligence, no one could even describe all the intelligences that it takes to drive a car. It was less than a year later that today's current head of Google's self-driving car division won a DARPA competition to have a self-driving car navigate its way through an obstacle course.
Yeah.
So their prediction was defunct within the year. And so when we look at the fact that, for example, in 2005, it would have been absurd to predict that cell phones would somehow threaten hotel jobs within a decade, we now have Airbnb, which uses smartphone and computer technology to allow people to rent out their homes and apartments, now worth $23 billion more than a lot of global hotel companies. So I think that what's happening now is we're not just dealing with the mechanical arms of the 1940s, 1950s, yeah, which so effectively could reproduce factory floor workers. We're dealing with a technology that can replace factory floor workers and office administrators and cashiers and radiologists. It's so dexterous that even making accurate predictions about what is the most next most automatable job is very hard to predict.
There's a study by Oxford University that you quote a few years ago that said, in the next 20 years, machines could perform half of all of the jobs in the United States. Put that in perspective for us.
So this is a really fascinating study, and I encourage people to look it up because it is pretty accessible. 2013, Oxford University researchers forecast that machines will be able to do half of U.S. jobs in the next two decades. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean take. It doesn't mean 50% unemployment, and I right. certainly don't think that we're going to see 50% unemployment in the 2020s. But they can do half of these jobs. And what they do is they align every single occupation in the U.S. from the most automatable to the least automatable. So let's say we have typists on the one end, which we know can be replaced because there's so much technology out there. You go into Apple's app system, you can download all sorts of things that convert voice to text. So typists we know are easily replaced on one end. And then on the other end, something like maybe anesthesiologists, which I don't think robots are going to do in any near future. But what's interesting to me is that there are some cases where I think they might not have gone far enough. So for example, the authors named psychologists as one of the occupations least likely to be computerizable. And certainly, many people would love their psychologist, love their therapist, would not replace it with a machine. But some research suggests that people are more honest in therapy sessions when they're confessing their most embarrassing troubles to a computer
right.
because machines don't pass moral judgment, and you can't feel embarrassed talking to a screen. It seems to me as well that if you combine this sort of confessional technology with the incredible database that IBM Watson has for deciding what sort of treatments and what sort of solutions are best for a particular person at a particular age in a particular geography with your experience, it's not so difficult to imagine some psychologist work being automated.
Hmm.
Now, this is not to suggest that psychologists are going the way of the textile worker
yeah.
and that we're going to have no psychologists in 2030. That's an absurd prediction. Rather, I think this shows how easily computers can encroach on areas we thought we could designate for humans only.
But don't you have to be careful saying that's an absurd prediction given the exponential increase in technology? Because one of the things you write about in the article, which I found really fascinating, is that kind of, I think, a really profound question at the heart of this issue, and that seems to be, are we humans really all that unique anymore? Because we like to tell ourselves a machine will never have the right kind of, sensitivity and dexterity and common sense, that it doesn't have true reasoning skills, it has no consciousness. But in the article you say, you call this the moat of what we believe machines cannot cross. But it seems like we don't really know what that moat is anymore with the increase in technology.
No, we don't. I mean, the economy will always be about servicing human needs, right? There is no economy, and I'm certainly not predicting an economy that exists merely to serve robots.
Sure.
So I do think that what makes humans unique in the economy is that the economy is for us, right? That the economy is geared around us, around what we want. The question then becomes, Can machines give us what we want better than people sometimes?
Right.
We already acknowledge this to be true in lots of enormous industries. Agriculture used to employ 40% of the economy. Now it employs 2% because tractors and agricultural technology developed in the 20th century produces much more food than humans could if we took technology off the farms. We like having machines in factories because it produces more stuff that we can buy for cheaper. So here you have machines clearly serving people. There are other categories, however, where I think somewhat interestingly, you can have too much technology. It's an interesting example I just thought of is Apple Music.
Yeah.
Apple Music, a week ago, said, you know, we're not just going to have an algorithm-driven music station like Pandora. We're also going to have playlists organized by real DJs, real humans saying, here's the music that I like. They're doing this because I think the smart marketers at Apple, the smart sort of psychologists or ersatz psychologists at Apple, understand that people who love music don't just want their own taste to be mechanically manipulated to serve what they want at every given second. Sometimes they just want to hear what a human is listening to. And so I think, you know, you have this spectrum between the farms and Apple Music, between areas where we understand machines can give us what we want better than people, and places where technology may have gone too far and we want to reinsert people in them. And so I want to be humble in not projecting that every single job is going to go away, even if I could suddenly imagine computers that were humans equal at doing all those jobs, because people will always put a sentimental value on the human touch.
Yeah, we're not. You're not calling for robot overlords just yet.
No. And I also think that, you know, in addition to visiting Youngstown, Ohio, I also visited Columbus, Ohio, in order to visit a maker space, which is sort of like a gymnasium of tools. And I visited there because I talked to an economist at Harvard, Lawrence Katz, very famous labor economist, who said, you know, I can envision this future somewhat ironically returning us to the 19th century, when the middle class was artisans. The middle class was silversmiths and blacksmiths. It was people making things with their hands before computers made the – or not computers, but before machines made those things faster and more efficiently. And there's a great possibility that somewhat ironically, you know, swimming in the technological abundance of the future, that some of us will have a certain passion for finding and buying things that still carry that element of the human touch. And it might, change some industries or change some jobs in ways that put a specific sentimental value on the human touch.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, culture is a funny thing, and it involves a lot of backlash. And if technology does creep further into the U.S. economy, I think that, you know, there are all sorts of cultural backlashes that one can anticipate.
We'll come back to that makerspace idea. The foundry, the Columbus foundry, because I want to break that down a little bit more when we get back from a break. Before we do that, though, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this sort of cultural breakdown that you write about, particularly in Youngstown. Depression, domestic violence, suicide all went up. Incarceration rates went way up. I think you said four prisons were built in that city.
Right.
So part of the story is about what happens to a culture and to the cultural cohesion of a place, as one professor called it. Would you talk about that dynamic? Because a lot of the questions, and I think a lot of the anxiety, surround what does happen to a society so dependent in the past on this idea of industriousness and work, and what happens when we don't know how to define work in the future.
Right. I would say two things. First, work is central around the world, and we have international studies to show that even countries that work less than the U.S. still very much value work. It is, however, I think, a particularly religious thing in the U.S., that work is something like the American religion. You see Democrats and Republicans aligned in saying we want to lower the unemployment rate. We want to maximize the total amount of work. There is an implicit understanding in the oxygen of the U.S. That work is important. And so I went to Columbus in Ohio, Columbus and Youngstown, both in Ohio, essentially at first to look at sort of utopia versus dystopia. Mm-hmm. What is the best scenario I could possibly imagine of people being freed from work, receiving a universal basic income from the government that covers basic needs, and finding wonderful things to do with their time that are better than the drudgery that exists? That's Columbus, or at least the part of Columbus that I wanted to show. Youngstown, I was looking, is more of an historical example of what happens when work goes away and people are decimated. But what I found is that the utopia and the dystopia were complicated. They were more like each other than I initially anticipated. When I went to Youngstown, which is an economy that is still shrinking, an economy that is still 3-4 decades after the collapse of September 1977, still struggling in its own ways, even though there are some signs of rejuvenation. What I found is you have a lot of people living in poverty who don't have one full-time job anymore. They have lots of little things that they do. They're a bartender, and they make shirts, and they write poetry, and maybe they play in a band, and maybe they're a cashier as well, and they do a little bit of retail on the side. And so the way that I thought about that as a replacement of the present that we understand is sort of the following thought experiment. It's when you go to a party, people say, "What do you do?" And you say one thing. "I'm a radio host. I'm a writer. I'm in marketing. I'm in retail." In Youngstown, it's as if you go to that party and someone says, not "What do you do?" but "What can you do?"
Right.
And they say, "Well, I can bartend, and I can play the guitar, and I can write, and I can do all of these other things, and I piece together a life from all of these jobs together." And so, somewhat ironically, in the city that used to be defined singularly by the steel industry is now defined sort of myriadly by resourcefulness, by the ability to do lots of things and to do things potentially that they're passionate about. I don't mean to suggest, I don't want to be overly sanguine and say that the gig economy or a portfolio, your career being a portfolio of industries is superior to what we have now. I'm simply saying that, you know, at the bottom of humans is always resilience. And so even in the poverty scenario of Youngstown, you've seen people face the end of work in a way and create sort of new values that might just be a glimpse of the broader country.
Derek Thompson is with us, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His article, "A World Without Work," appears as the cover story in the magazine's July edition. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'd like to hear from you. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. What are you making of this new era of work? 801-585-9378. We'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to imagine what the world would be like without work. It's always been exciting to imagine a future where machines would free us from the toils of labor, but what happens when we get there? Because in a lot of different industries, we're getting close. Self-driving cars and drones and robots being designed for operating rooms and fast food restaurants. The journalist Derek Thompson is joining us today. He explores all of this in a new article for The Atlantic Magazine. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Derek Thompson, you've distilled the possible futures or the possible outcomes into three categories, and I wanted to go through some of these. Consumption, that is, some are just going to focus on leisure in the absence of work. I want to talk about that. There's also creativity, which we've touched on a bit, but others who are imagining building, you know, these productive communities. And there's the kind of the bleaker one, although the more complicated one, this idea of contingency, as you say. Let's start with consumption. What happens in a world of abundance because we've always accepted that we have to work. But there is this group of people you write about in your article called the post-workists who say that that's a good thing. We don't really need work, at least not in that sense.
Right. The post-workists, they acknowledge that even in the best post-work scenarios, you know, there will be some things that don't go away, that pride and jealousy will persevere, reputation will always be scarce even in this economy of abundance. But fundamentally, they believe that with the right government services and the right government policies, like a universal basic income, this scenario would allow for a golden age of well-being.
Yeah.
There's a lovely quote by Benjamin Honeycutt, a professor, who said that colleges could reemerge as cultural centers rather than job prep institutions. The word school, he pointed out, comes from a Greek word, skol, which means leisure. He said, and this is one of my favorite quotes in the piece, quote, "We used to teach people to be free. Now we teach them to work."
Right.
And, you know, even as I am less optimistic than the post-workists are about how happy people can be when they're simply released from the possibility of work, they get so much right that paid labor doesn't always map to social good, that we pay, you know, some financiers enormous gobs of money to do very little observable social good and pay very little to people who take care of the old and the sick and the young who either receive no money or receive very little. And so, you know, their vision is appealing in a lot of ways. But, you know, the reason that I can't fully buy into the vision is that there's simply too much psychological research that suggests that when people aren't working, when they're inactive, when they're not bound to a purpose, they become aimless and idle. They give themselves up to leisure. Mm-hmm. And they lose something more than contentment, which I think speaks in the present tense, but pride, purpose. We tend to be most proud of things that we have done, that we have accomplished. And I'm worried that this future that they paint is one in which it will be more difficult to accomplish things that give us pride.
801-585-WEST, the number two. Join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Mike is with us in Park City. Mike, welcome.
Hi, thanks for bringing up this topic. I find it absolutely fascinating. I'm curious how income inequality is going to factor into this, because it seems like the top 10, 1%, however you name it, are the ones who are going to own the software, who will own the companies and the robots, and the rest of us will be the ones whose jobs are being cut. And it actually seems to me that to some degree that is happening now with our current situation. I mean, I think of jobs answering phones that have been taken over by robots, just for one example. And I'll take my answer off, so yeah, thank you.
Derek Thompson, what do you think?
This is a great question. And it is not entirely clear, first, how much of income inequality as we can observe it today can be attributed to technology. This is a really complicated issue. I should say, though, that in the piece, one policy solution that I propose is something called a universal basic income.
Yeah.
This is an idea that is currently most popular, I would say, among liberals, maybe libertarians, certainly not among conservatives. But rather ironically, this was an idea that was bandied about by President Richard Nixon. A version of it was proposed by the conservative economist Milton Friedman. It's the idea, essentially, that either through the tax code or through direct spending, we provide people, the government provides people, with a minimum basic income that they get from the government every single month to live, whether or not they have a job. Very simply, it is Social Security for everyone. So on the one hand, this is only possible if we have a certain amount of workers, rich workers, who can be taxed and have that money distributed throughout the rest of the economy. Not to steal whatever thunder I was, you know, you might have asked me about this question later in this segment, but let me just say that my concern with the policy of universal basic income is that right now we have some conservatives saying in presidential elections, for example, that they want to lower taxes on the rich because we have an economy of makers versus takers. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, that's not true. Right now, you have a lot of low-income people who are working and not just taking. But in a future where you had a leisure class, a post-work leisure class, simply getting money from the government and doing nothing ostensibly to earn it, then this accusation of makers and takers becomes even more politically salient. And I'm concerned about the politics of universal basic income if we don't attach it to some sort of requirement of work or activity. But I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself there, and I should just say, I guess, in direct response to the caller, that you know, income inequality is a problem, but we could maybe begin to help those at the bottom with a policy like universal income.
Mike, thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Todd is with us in Salt Lake. Todd, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about, you know, kind of purely creative pursuits like songwriting, for instance, speaking of Taylor Swift. You know, could software take over something that involves so much human creativity? What is your opinion on that?
Yeah.
That's a great question.
It does come up in the article. That's that human mode again, I guess, probably.
Right. This is a great question. I guess I have two responses. The first response is that my last feature for The Atlantic was actually about big data and music. And how the music industry was relying more on algorithms and software and data to sort of predict the next big hit. And one really fascinating finding was a study, I believe, out of Harvard that played music written by a robot and then had, I think, a very, very similar song played by people. And listeners preferred the version played by people. Played by humans, not the robot. And so, but it was, I think, essentially the same song. And so, you know, why? Can we hear something that is distinctly human? And the researcher suggested, yes, that there is something, in his words, perfectly imperfect about the way that people play instruments, that the human ear can detect and prefers. And so this is one of those areas where, you know, I don't want to make the prediction that that there are certain moats that machines can never pass, but this certainly is among the widest of moats, is artistic expression. One point that I make in the piece, the second point I'd like to make to the caller, is, you know, I visit this makerspace in Columbus to sort of get a glimpse at a future where people are freed from drudgery and can pursue creative passions. But I don't mean to suggest that makerspaces are the only way that people can be creative. In fact, I think that today you see tens of millions of people essentially working for free in online communities, making art, writing, making music, in order to receive feedback and appreciation rather than receive money. The internet is, I guess, people upload 400,000 hours of YouTube videos every day. They upload 350 million Facebook photos every single day. This is labor that is not compensated with money, but is compensated rather with status and achievement and pride.
Yeah.
And so I like the idea of an economy where artists and writers and craftspeople have the means to devote their time to the creation of cultural products. I think that's a lovely vision.
I think this is the perspective of a caller who's joining us now, Aaron from Salt Lake City. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm a small business owner here in Salt Lake. I just had a question for Derek. I just wanted to know why you kind of assumed that a universal basic income would make people kind of, you know, listless and aimless. I've very much been a supporter of UBI for quite some time, but I also own a small business. I'm kind of living under poverty right now because the business isn't generating enough to kind of sustain me, but I'm getting by. But with universal basic income, that would really free up capital in my business. So, I mean, I think it's wrong to assume that people would just be aimless and listless and I'll just take my question off the air.
It's not what you said, though, is it, Derek Thompson?
Well, no, this is a totally fair question, and it's a question that I try to address in the piece. So I'll just go right there. I encourage the reader to read the piece, and I will tell him even more specifically that the answer to his question is in Section 3. So Section 3 sort of looks at this question that I call the paradox of leisure. And after interviewing the post-workists and asking, you know, why are you excited about a world where a lot of jobs have gone away and people are free, I find, though, that, you know, by and large, if you look at what unemployed people do today, it is not particularly creative or industriousness or industrious. And this comes from data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
They sit around and watch TV, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, women are better at this than men. You know, these time use surveys find that women do dedicate some of their time to cleaning and childcare. But men in particular devote the vast majority of their unemployed free time to leisure, the lion's share of which is spent watching TV, browsing the internet, and sleeping. Retired seniors watch about 50 hours of television a week, according to Nielsen. So we're looking, you know, at the data right now to see, you know, this is a question that I was incredibly interested in, is what's the most realistic thing one can expect lots of people to do if they're not working? And unfortunately, it just seems like most, you know, prime age workers, unlike our caller, aren't cultivating new hobbies and spending a lot more time with people. In fact, they're spending less time with people. They're self-isolating. And perhaps they're self-isolating because they don't have money to hang out, and perhaps it's also because of shame. But the example of unemployment today should not necessarily make us sanguine about people's activities with a UBI, is my take.
Right, and I think what you're saying is, Aaron, maybe the exception, but you do write about the exceptions. People like Alex Bandar, who was at the Columbus Idea Foundry that you referenced earlier. And he has this interesting theory that may go to sort of Aaron's perspective, because he believes in what he calls the rhythms of invention in American history. At least that's how you put it in the article. This idea Right. that this pendulum is going to swing back, that once we're freed up, we're going to be way more creative, way more productive, and it's going to be to the good, I guess.
Right. It was a fascinating conversation. Alex is a perfect interview. Essentially, he told me, you know, over the past century, the economy has moved from hardware to software, from atoms to bits, to bytes, and people have spent more time in front of screens. But as computers take over a lot of these jobs, as automation takes over a lot of these jobs, he thinks the pendulum is going to swing back. From bits to atoms, from software to creative production. This is a lovely, it's impossible to test empirically because the future affords us no data, but it's a lovely idea that ironically, you know, as we're swimming in all of this technological abundance, we're somewhat ironically drawn back as if by undertow into the thing that our ancestors were doing 200 years ago, which is, you know, when they were in the middle class being artists, being machinists and, you know, silversmiths. You know, making, you know, doing things with steel, and that, you know, rather than you know, work with steel and fire, that we might do the same thing on the internet by creating cultural products and spending a lot of time, you know, creating online communities that had the same sort of water cooler effects that today's offices have. There are so many ways that one can imagine technological displacement to be bad, but I did in the piece want to be clear that there are also ways that with the right policies, we really could be freed up from the drudgery that is so much work today and be allowed to sort of express ourselves creatively.
Aaron, thanks a lot. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. One more call before we go to a break. Marshall has been waiting in Logan. Marshall, hi.
Hi. So I am a college student going to college to go to a radiology technologist. And so I'm curious, because you mentioned that radiology was something that could possibly be replaced. So should I be looking for other like work, or should I be Like, what do I have to look forward to in the future if I'm going into the healthcare field?
It's such a good practical question. And you do write about this really susceptible jobs, the ones that are most susceptible to being replaced by machines, the ones that right now seem like they're going to be okay for a while. How do you respond to those kinds of questions? Because I'm guessing you get a lot of really practical questions like that.
Right. Let me say a few things. First, I encourage the caller to just go online and Google this Oxford study of computerizability. Computerizable is the term that they use to sort of maybe see what the arrangement of healthcare jobs by their automatability. That will take you no time. The deeper piece of advice that I would say, though, is that I'm making a prediction about the future that might be wrong. I could be completely wrong about this, and technology might not permanently replace a lot of these jobs, and we could have full employment through the 2060s and 2070s and 2080s, and when you're in your 80s and 90s and retired. There's something to be said for doing the thing that you love. And if you're fascinated by radiology, and if you love it, and if this is the thing that feeds your soul, then the theme of my article would actually suggest that you should absolutely follow that, because that's the thing that you're going to do best. Do I think, practically speaking, that radiology is at greater risk than other jobs that could receive a similar income at a hospital in your metro area? I do think that it's probably more at risk, that it might be more computerizable, but that alone is not a reason to change your career, particularly if it's the thing you're most passionate about doing.
Marshall, thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number 2. Join the conversation. We are with Derek Thompson. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His article, A World Without Work, appears as the cover story in the magazine's July edition. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. 801-585-WEST is our number to join the conversation. Our email address, by the way, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the journalist Derek Thompson. We're talking about his new article in The Atlantic Magazine, A World Without Work. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's an email from Robert, who writes, Robert is a theater professor. He writes, "My students and I take comfort in thinking that live theater may be an area that will always require human performers. The phenomenon of live theater is in its essence the simultaneous performance and reception of human storytelling through personas." I can't read that word right there. Sorry about that. But we get the point, I suppose. Derek Thompson, what about this idea, live theater performance, as being one of those things that won't cross that moat, at least anytime soon?
This is really interesting. First, I should say, with full disclosure, I was an actor before I was a journalist, so I have a deep sentimental interest in the preservation of theater. Let me make sort of the pessimistic point and then end with the optimistic point. The pessimistic point is that live theater, has already been disrupted and deeply affected by technology. That 200 years ago, 100 years ago even, there was no such thing as a television. If you wanted to watch people perform, you had to go to a theater to watch that story. But then you had the invention of movies in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the popularization of movies, which experienced their heyday at least as a share of U.S. entertainment in the middle of the 20th century. But then you had the proliferation of televisions, a smaller technological screen, begin to reduce the number of tickets bought per year by American movie fans, and television had its heyday. But now we're seeing sort of the disruption being disrupted because phones and all the information and entertainment that we can get on our own computers and our smartphones is making television less relatively popular. So in a way, you know, one could say that lots of forms of theater, like opera, were eroded first by movies, then that erosion was eroded by television, and that erosion was eroded by smartphones. So there's lots of reasons to see here how innovations and products that nobody could have possibly predicted in the 1850s had a huge effect on live theater's popularity for the next 150 years. That's the downside. The good thing, though, is that I thought a lot in writing this piece about how culture sort of evolves. We had that beautiful description by Alex Bandar about the rhythms of innovation. Culture has rhythms too. Something becomes popular and then you have a backlash, and then that backlash goes too far and it becomes popular again. It seems quite probable to me that as we swim in a lot of technological abundance, there will still be a role for things that require a human touch and live people. And in fact, there are some industries where the importance and the primacy of real live people could become even more important because we become sick of too many algorithms and too much software and too little human interaction. So I can imagine both an answer to that question that says that live theater has already been quite seriously challenged by other entertainment technologies, but also the possibility that maybe it could have a renaissance as people value it more in the face of sort of too much screen-based entertainment.
Let me tidy up that Robert's question, which I scribbled over and I couldn't read his writing. He was talking about human storytelling and impersonation. Robert, thanks very much. Sorry. 801-585 West, the number to join us. Sorry, did you want to keep going, Derek Thompson?
No, that's fine.
Let's take a call from Ed. Sorry, Ed is with us in Garden City, Utah. Ed, welcome.
Good, and enjoy your cereal, Doug. I'm sitting here kind of worried about this kind of cultural arrogance that was shown here about the first world and work. Having lived in the third world, I saw moral decisions made by governments which said, should we automate public records or displace 400 workers? And they chose not to automate because they didn't want to displace those workers.
Where is this?
It was in Central Africa.
Well, Derek Thompson, you hear that argument that, and in fact, why don't you just talk a little bit about that? Because you say that the country is going to, the world, I suppose, is going to have to embrace radical new roles for government. What about this idea? What can the government do to impose, impose itself on a free market system, on a free market economy?
This is a very interesting idea. This is essentially what the caller is sort of suggesting. Is that governments faced with the possibility of equality, spreading out the total amount of work that needs to be done among more people, and efficiency, choosing technology over human work, will choose equality, possibly for political purposes, possibly for moral purposes or whatever. We do see around the world, not only in Africa, where this caller clearly has been, but also in China, in Japan, in Brazil, in Europe, jobs that I won't say the full word, but they are considered, quote, BS jobs by some economists. That's actually the official jargon. Jobs that don't need to be done, but exist because the governments are interested in having more people participate in the labor economy. Now, I guess I'll say two things about this. On the one hand, it's possible that this persists in the U.S., although I think given the way that the WPA is talked about now by at least one of the political parties, it seems unlikely to me that American politics, at least at the national level, is equally willing to embrace this solution to the problem of the end of work. The second thing that I would say, though, is that my interest in this piece is not merely in the maximization of human labor, the maximization of official employment. My interest is in people's happiness, not only as measured in moment-to-moment contentment, but also as measured in meaning and purpose. And so is the most meaningful thing you can do with your time. To take what is a essentially, you know, quote, BS job from the federal government? Or is the better solution to have another sort of policy, like a universal basic income, that we pay out to everybody so that they can choose to do what they want to do, what's more valuable for them, which at least theoretically, according to Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, will be more valuable to others. So, yes, it's possible that some governments might choose that solution. I think that it is not the optimal response to the problem that I'm addressing.
Ed, thanks for the call. You also write about this sort of contingency future, which seems like the bleakest of them all, but maybe the most realistic, certainly the most complex, as you say. One aspect of all of this is this, where we have this kind of class called the precariat, if I've pronounced that properly.
Right.
This is the kind of on-demand economy of the internet age.
Right. Precariat essentially is this this newish term. It's a portmanteau of precarious and proletariat. So it's the idea of a working class that is constantly under the threat of losing their jobs, having certain rights taken away. You know, there's an argument that we're seeing sort of inklings of this right now with the rise of so-called on-demand companies, Uber and Lyft and TaskRabbit. And you know, it's interesting that we're in the process right now of some of these, of the question of, are their workers employees or contractors? This is a legal distinction that's currently being worked out in the courts right now. But what's also interesting about these sort of on-demand companies, at least they factor into the piece, is that what they do is they take a job like being a taxi driver. And they break it up into a lot of tasks, the task being driving someone from place A to place B, so that those tasks are spread over many people rather than concentrated in one formal job. And so you have the growth of Uber drivers slowly, I think, eclipsing the number of rides taken by people in the cars of drivers for whom that is their one salary job. And so this goes sort of to the issue of work sort of first being decentralized and then perhaps being automated, precisely because Uber is in the process of working on a self-driving car just like Google. So you have these issues sort of coming together in interesting ways. You know, lots of evidence that full-time jobs are if not necessarily being threatened, certainly seeing alternatives in the economy with the rise of automation. And it's the way that they interact that could be really interesting to watch in the near future.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His article is called A World Without Work. It appears as the cover story in the magazine, and you can get a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Derek Thompson joined us today from the offices of The Atlantic in New York City. And Derek, thank you very much for the time.
Yeah, thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Daniel Lombardi, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.